A stunning, abrupt climate shift is possible. During the last ice age, temperatures in Greenland heated up anywhere from 5 to 16 degrees Celsius in decades. That is up to 28 degrees Fahrenheit hotter. The Arctic is already warming beyond anything seen by modern humans, and last year, Arctic sea ice levels, well, they were the second lowest ever recorded. Are we rushing toward that tipping point now? Our guest is Dr. Sune Olander Rasmussen, Distinguished Associate Professor at the Center for Ice and Climate in Denmark's Niels Bohr Institute. He's co-author of the new paper published in Nature Communications April 8, 2021, The Anatomy of Past Abrupt Warmings Recorded in Greenland Ice. From Copenhagen, Denmark, Sune, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, before we get to the causes of such big changes, which we all want to know, what would one of these abrupt climate shifts around Greenland and the North Atlantic look like?
That's a pretty good question that a lot of people are working on. First of all, these shifts happen from the full glacial state. So we're starting off from a point which is massively colder than today. So we're in the central part of the glacial period where large parts of North America and Canada and Scandinavia were covered but with ice sheets. And then we see an abrupt climate change, which happens in sometimes a few decades, even maybe less than that, up to a century or two, during which a number of features of the climate system change more or less together. The sea ice changed very dramatically from a state where there was sea ice far into the North Atlantic. We had temperature changes, as you said, from 5 to 16 degrees, and we had a change in circulation pattern. All happening together, this is what the paper is investigating, is how these different factors of climate, how they change and how they relate to each other.
And in a timeline in your new paper, we see sudden variations of Greenland temperatures in the period between 30 and 50,000 years ago. And we have not had such a rapid shift in the Arctic during the last 10,000 years. Do we know why the climate has been so stable? And are we due for a big Greenland warming anyway?
This is what everybody wants to know. We can't really answer that question yet. This is a study that helps us understand the nature of these climate shifts, the mechanisms involved, and hopefully this will help us be able to predict or maybe not predict, but evaluate the risk of us going into a similar situation. Again, similar in the sense that we're not in a glacial now, so we can't have the same type of climate change that we had in the past. Well, we can still have an abrupt climate change, which involves some of the same mechanisms. So changes in circulation patterns, in sea ice, in temperature. So this is what we're worried about. This is why we, apart from just being curious, this is why we're so interested in these past climate changes, because there are many of them. There are about 30, depending on how you count them, during the glacial. They were most pronounced and most regular during the central part of the glacial from 60 to 30,000 years ago. But we have enough of them to be able to kind of study them and say, is there a typical pattern? Because often we only have a few instances of climate change, and it's very hard to derive the general picture from just a few cases. And what we set out to do here was to say, okay, can we analyze these repeated climate changes and find out whether there is kind of a fingerprint? And that fingerprint would then serve as a warning sign if we see the same fingerprint today. So that's what we set out to do. What we then found was that the climate changes, even though it's the same parameters that change, the order, when you look at the really fine details, the order of when these different parts of the climate system changed is different from time to time. They all change from one level to another, but they do it in slightly different ways. And this leads us to conclude that most likely these processes are so closely entangled that if one of them changes, the rest of them change too. And that is worrying also in a modern climate scenario because, as you say, sea ice is changing today. Sea ice has been changing over the last decades, and this is one of the factors that changed in the past. And we're yet not able to say if this means that it can set off a similar set of events in the future, but it's definitely a step in understanding the mechanisms behind it.
Well, this is one of the frustrating things a little about your paper, and must have been for you as scientists, is that the human mind wants a nice linear progression. Well, the sea ice goes out, and then the ocean currents weaken, and then this happens, and then that happens. But here we find something more like instruments in an orchestra playing in concert, and they apparently can come up in different order.
I mean, as I said, we set out to find the archetypical climate change in terms of, we used the analogy of dominoes. So which pieces are involved and in which order did they topple over and which dominoes will topple over which? So like the idea of there being a trigger, the first domino that started to tip and then the rest would follow suit. And what we found was that it's the same dominoes every time, but they're lined up probably in a little bit different way every time. So it's not the same one that starts to topple. Eventually they all fall. And this is where the domino analogy breaks down, because every time before the first one has fallen all the way down and it's on the table, all the other ones have started falling too. So it's not that one sets off everything and then once that is completed, something else happens. Different which one starts, but they all change together. And this is what, in a way, is both very intriguing and also a little bit worrying, because it indicates that processes are so closely intertwined or entangled that you can't change one without the others.
So when temperatures around Greenland shot up around 12 degrees C or more, about 21 degrees Fahrenheit, was that an isolated regional event, or did it affect weather and climate around the world? I believe you co-authored a paper about that last year in the journal Science.
There are many types of climate change. And it's pretty important to understand that this is these Danskerisker events, as they're called, these abrupt climate changes in Greenland, they are related to a change in the distribution of heat around the globe, more than a change of the mean temperature. So when Greenland gets a lot of warm air, then that heat is being transported from somewhere else. It also changes on a much smaller scale the average temperature on Earth. But the regional impact is much, much bigger than the global impact. So when Greenland goes into one of these warm phases, Antarctica starts to cool very slowly. And as long as Greenland is in the warm phase, heat is being tapped away from the southern hemisphere, and Antarctica, where we have also had ice cores and can do similar analysis, is slowly cooling. So we call it the bipolar seesaw, because it's two ends of the seesaw. We can't really compare this with global warming, or we can also not compare it with the deglaciation when Earth went from deep freeze into the current interglacial, because this was, say, more or less a globally homogeneous change. Not that everybody saw the same change, but the direction was roughly the same everywhere. In these climate changes, heat is being moved around on Earth in a different way than it used to be. So it's more like a conveyor belt kind of change.
Still, one could only fear what the effects on fish and on agriculture and on living species of all kinds might be when their regional climates go through big changes within a couple of decades. You can't evolve fast enough to deal with that.
Exactly. And this is, in a broader picture, this is something that I think worries me and a lot of other climate researchers, is that we tend to talk about global climate change, but nobody lives in the global climate. We all live in local climates. And the effect of global climate change is very likely that some regions will experience much stronger and more abrupt climate changes than the global average. And the people living in those regions will have to adapt or move. And those adaptations can be hard to do, because change can be relatively strong compared to these. We see these curves from the IPCC or from other efforts to do the best projections we can of what's going to happen in the future. These curves are always very smooth. And we tend to discuss the amplitude of these. Do we want to invest heavily in measures that can reduce the warming so we stay below 1.5 or 2 degrees? Or, it's always, it's a smooth curve that we want to keep below a certain cap. But if we get anything like the changes we saw in the past, then the local changes or the regional changes are going to be a lot bigger than that. And it doesn't help you much if you live in an area that suddenly gets much, much warmer, that somebody else is having a cooler time. So it's not always the average that matters. And these changes were very abrupt. And even though we don't think we will get exactly the same, because these were from a glacial state to begin with, we can still worry that the same mechanisms can induce climate change, which is strong enough and abrupt enough to really be a problem. That's the whole problem about climate change. It's extremely hard to predict. We don't even talk about prediction. We talk about, if we're really good, we may get to a point where we can assess the risk. Not say when it will happen, but just say what the risk of it happening within a certain time frame would be. That would in itself be a big step forward. And this is what we're working on. And I sometimes think this agenda gets tucked away a little bit in the back compared to the argument about keeping average temperature or average climate change below a certain threshold, because the local regional impact can be a lot stronger than that.
Well, I totally agree with you. Now, what are the factors that you did look at? I mean, we have Arctic sea ice, we have global temperature. So what were the dominoes, so to speak?
We rely on what's called proxy data because we can't measure past temperatures directly. So we rely on what we can measure in ice cores, and then we can transfer that to something we really want to know. So this is why it's called proxy data. And so in terms of temperature, we have isotopes of the ice core that can tell us what the temperature was. We have the calcium and the dust content of the ice core that tells us something about how efficient the atmosphere is at transporting impurities from Asia to Greenland. So it's related to the storminess of the atmosphere and also to the amount of dust available, which will rely mainly on the wind and the dryness of the areas where the dust come from. Then we have sodium, which at least to some degree tells us something about sea ice, probably other factors too. So these are all, you know, all proxies that we can derive from the ice core. We also have the layer thickness, which will tell us simply how much snow fell in Greenland. So these are all indirect measures. What we then did to see if we could make sense of this was to run a climate model that will produce the direct observables that we're really interested in, and then compare how the model version of reality looked relative to our data. And that was a very good correspondence. So we think we have some backing in interpreting the data from the ice core the way we do.
So you did cross-check your ice core data against a climate model?
Cross-check. I mean, we cross-checked two ice cores against each other to make sure that these were not just local flukes that we were interpreting, that they represented a regional climate signal. And then in interpreting what the climate data from the ice core is telling us, we used a computer model, a climate model. This is a very fruitful way to let model and data work together, I think. And it's the only option we really have in the past, because we don't have all the data we want, on one hand, and on the other hand, we don't have access to all the mechanisms of the climate system that can be really hard to derive from just one data series, which is located on an ice sheet close to the polar regions, in the polar regions. So that way, using a model which gives you a more globally distributed picture of what's going on, and where you can delve into the mechanisms and say, you know, what happened, which, as you said, the ocean currents is a big issue here. But obviously, an ice core does not directly record the ocean currents. So in this way, we can see, you know, we have some proxy data that, for example, the temperature will rely on where the moisture comes from. And when the sea ice and the ocean currents change, we can see that forms a coherent picture that we then believe enough to interpret as a change in sea ice and ocean currents, even though it's not what we directly are measuring.
Well, some scientists have suggested that this Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, or AMOC, is the principal driver of changes on Greenland. But now this paper seems to cast some doubt on that?
I wouldn't say that. I think it adds a layer to the explanation of why the AMOC is changing. Because some people tend to think that the AMOC triggers everything. Like the AMOC is in the driver's seat and then everything else follows. I don't think anybody is really suggesting that the AMOC does not play a big role in these climate changes. But whether it's the trigger is still an open question. It could also be that atmospheric changes or sea ice is helping tip the ocean currents, the AMOC, which then feeds back on the climate system. So in terms of what the trigger is, I think the jury is still out. If there is a trigger at all, you could also interpret our new results in the way that you don't need a trigger, because it's the collective action of all these parts of the climate system, and the same ones every time, that creates the changes. And maybe if one starts to change, and that could just happen because the system has been in a cold state for a while and there's some heat accumulating in subsurface ocean, this heat will be buoyant, and that at some point breaks through. That influences sea ice. But maybe a wind anomaly or sea ice anomaly can also initiate this process once the system is close to being able to tip. So it's a very, I know it gets very hairy, but I would say that in terms of understanding what triggers these abrupt changes, we're really advancing our knowledge these years, but it's still not clear whether an outside external trigger is needed or whether it's the internal process in the system that just allows for rapid change between cold state and a mild state, and that this hunt for a trigger is maybe elusive.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from the University of Copenhagen. Our guest is Dr. Sune Olander Rasmussen. We are talking about abrupt radical warming in the Arctic, which happened many times in the last 100,000 years. And could it come again? We don't know. So would you talk to us, please, about the appearance of time lags in this process of abrupt warming? And there's a reason why I ask you this.
So a time lag between the different processes?
Yes. Are there time lags involved? Could something actually be happening even right now, but we're presently just stuck in the time lag and we'll see it soon?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can see, if you look at the different processes that played into these past climate changes, they were lagging by decades of each other, and they weren't always in the same order. So one process would start at one occasion, and then at the next occasion, about 30 of these, it would be something else that started, and then other processes would follow suit. So there are time lags involved there. Then in this north-south communication that I mentioned between the climate of the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere, there's also a time lag of around 100 years before the changes make their way all the way to Antarctica. So the climate system is full of these decadal scale lags, because you need maybe to build, you know, when you start pulling heat up north, you're taking it away from the southern ocean, from the oceans, the center of the oceans. You need to build up a gradient. You need to build up a difference before this change will penetrate into, for example, Antarctica. It's very hard to get a signal to Antarctica. So this is where you get the biggest lag, a 100-year lag, because you need to get across the ocean and atmospheric circulation patterns that circulate around Antarctica and makes Antarctica very well insulated. So decadal lags or even centennial lags are very common in the climate system, and we see these, and they're also likely to be relevant today.
Well, Sune, suppose we reach a tipping point where these various factors sway together towards a big change. How long would that take? Do we know?
No, I don't think we know. I mean, the combination will be different from what we know from the past, because we're starting from a different setup. We're starting from an interglacial warm state rather than a cold state. But the processes, you know, in the past changed over, you know, the fastest ones over a few decades. And we could definitely expect to see that time scale involved. But there were also some of them that were, which were slower. So it's extremely hard to put a number to it. But the decadal to centennial scale changes, it doesn't sound like much in terms of abruptness when you compare to a human lifetime. But when you compare to the factors that changed climate in the natural cycle before humans started to interfere, these are very, very abrupt.
Well, yes. I mean, it is possible that there could be a major change within a human lifetime, and that's pretty fast and pretty significant.
It's fast enough, isn't it? It's fast enough.
In a recent Radio EcoShock interview, we had Johannes Lohmann, a young scientist from Niels Bohr, and he explained that the speed of climate change can bring tipping points sooner than most models suggest. So we are in uncharted territory here. Do you think human-induced climate change will make another abrupt Arctic warming more likely or happen sooner?
More likely, definitely. And if it happens, then it gives you the answer to the second question. If it happens and you've been increasing the risk, then it would also happen sooner, yes. Whether it happens is still an open question. And I think if we talk about reasons why we should try to mitigate climate change, me as a person, as a father of three, I'm a lot more worried about abrupt climate change than the gradual climate change. Not that I'm not worried about 2 or 2.5 degrees in 100 years, but I'm very worried about the abrupt climate change, because in a densely populated planet, abrupt climate change can have a very large regional impact. And if that region is heavily populated, that will cause geopolitical implications beyond what I would like to imagine. So I think reducing the risk of something like that is at least as good an argument as the argument for reducing the amplitude of the projected climate change, the gradual climate change. So it's kind of two sides of the same thing, because by reducing the slow general global climate change, you're probably also reducing the risk of abrupt climate change. You can, analogy would be if you're in a boat and you know the boat can tip over, you're not starting to dance around, are you? I mean, you'd like to stay a little bit still. And the more you learn about your boat as being unstable, the more quiet you want to be. So with that analogy, I'd like us not to rock the boat too much. And one way to not rock the boat is to reduce the climate change of all sorts. But in terms of what I'm most worried about as a human being, it's definitely the consequence of that abrupt climate change rather than the gradual ones, which is bad enough. But I think the abrupt ones, they're so hard to imagine, and therefore, because we're only talking about risk assessment, it's really hard, and I don't want to say exactly what will happen because that would be pure speculation. But looking in the back, looking back at how ecosystems reacted when we had these abrupt climate changes in the past, it's bad enough.
Yes, these are not minor concerns. Look, I know that you don't want to predict, what will happen because we don't know, but still, Denmark is a partner with the Greenlandic government, and we have to think that just on a very regional effort, this change, should it happen, would affect Greenland hugely, and it would also probably change the weather in Northern Europe, the UK, and even Denmark, wouldn't you think?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and of course, is it a problem that weather changes? Is it climate change? It depends a lot on the people who live in the areas. And when these changes happened, I don't know the number, but I've heard estimates that the population in Europe was like 100,000 people or so. And they were all migrants. They were hunter-gatherers, and they would adapt and they would move around. And you would have to move several hundred kilometers, if not thousands, in a lifetime to adapt to the changing conditions when these climate changes happened. Which was, if you ask the people back then, they would probably be at least mildly annoyed, but there was space enough. And people hadn't settled and they hadn't built large cities and infrastructure that was hard to bring with them. So I think it's really hard to use anything from the past as an analogy to how things will look if we have a climate change in the future. Not because I want to be no fear-mongering, but we are a lot of people on Earth now, and a lot of people rely on their livelihoods from areas which are very densely populated and very heavily farmed because conditions are good right there. And those areas could definitely experience serious change.
What still needs to be done to understand these risks better? And what are you working on these days?
Yeah, it's a super, super interesting and hard question because even though we have 30 of these, it's still a relatively small number in terms of statistics. And they all come from a different starting point as what we have today. So we're trying to understand this both in terms of getting our models to capture these abrupt climate changes. The model we used for this study does capture the ones in the past. And we're trying to figure out to what degree we can trust it in also capturing similar changes in the future. It's a big job, and it's super difficult because these models are extremely expensive to run in terms of computing time. So there's a limit to how many experiments you can make. But that's one line of work. Another line is more theoretical work in understanding how complex dynamical systems with lots of parts that interact, how these systems change. And there's some theory, as you talked with Johannes Lohmann recently, he's an expert in that. So there are some general features in the behavior of these systems that you can derive and learn from. And then as a data person, of course, we go back and try to find data from all parts of the world, speleothems, so dripstones from caves, marine sediments, ice cores, try to get a picture which is as comprehensive as possible with as good spatial coverage, geographical coverage, and temporal coverage as possible, and also try to get these records aligned so that we know not only what happened, but also tease out the finer details in how change is propagated. But it's not something that's going to be done here at the end of the week. It's a long haul, and it's already been going on for decades. But it is a climate system so immensely complex that this is something that's going to take some time.
Well, it's amazing we can do it at all, that science can retrieve the memory of Earth long before humans ever set foot on it.
Isn't it fantastic? It all comes back, from a Copenhagen perspective, it all comes back to Professor Vigge Damsgaard, who would have been 100 years old soon, who came up with this idea that isotopes capture the temperature of the past, and that you could go to ice sheets and find old layers of accumulation. This was a very, very good idea. Keeps us busy still today. Of course, we have lots more methods and a lot of other types of measurements that we've added on. But the whole basic idea that the ice sheets capture in a very ordered and layered sense the precipitation of the past, and then we can go back and retrieve this and still find layer by layer, year by year, how climate changed well into the glacial. And I think this is what keeps me going. I think it's an amazing thing that it's possible, and it keeps opening up new questions that you can answer.
Perfect. From the Niels Bohr Institute at the University of Copenhagen, we've been speaking with geophysicist and Carlsberg Foundation Distinguished Associate Professor Sune Olander Rasmussen. find links to the free access paper, The Anatomy of Past Abrupt Warmings, recorded in Greenland Ice, in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Sune, thank you so much for sharing your time and your insight with us.
Thank you very much for talking to me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.